This is Dishing Dirt with Gary Pickren, South Carolina's only podcast dedicated to the real estate agent's craft. And greetings, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of our extremely low-budgeted production of Dishing Dirt. I am your often irreverent and very opinionated, but rarely wrong, host Gary Pickren, and I'm coming to you deep inside Blair Cato in the famously hot downtown Columbia, South Carolina. You know, the last of May here, but it might as well read July on our calendar, as the heat indexes are as hot as Winona Ryder's clothes from Saks Fifth Avenue. Nevertheless, before we get into our topics, I do have some exciting news. Last week, I was elected to the South Carolina Real Estate Commission to serve as an at-large member, seat that was left vacant by the untimely and unfortunate death of Wayne Poplin, who will absolutely be greatly missed. I'm very excited about this challenge, and I'm hoping to bring a lot of value to the industry. And you may notice some small changes in the future on this podcast once I'm sworn in. Basically, there'll be a disclaimer that simply says the podcast is not necessarily the opinions of the Real Estate Commission, even though they probably should be because, you know, they're my opinions. But other than that, I may tone it down some bit with my irreverence, but I doubt it because I always like just calling things like I see it anyway. So a few weeks ago, Becky Ashby and I examined the difference in the state contract and the Central Carolina Realtors contract in a webinar that we did for CCRA. Becky is on the contract committee. She is the head of our contract committee and has been so for a couple years now. So we had several hundred people attend that webinar in which Byron King and Austin Smallwood from the State Association presented issues with the state contract, and then we compared how that may differ from the Central Carolina Realtors Association contract. Most of you are now getting contracts from multiple sources, from agents from outside your normal MLS. So whether you're in the upstate, you're in Florence, you're in the Midlands, in the Lowcountry, whatever market contract you use, you need to also be familiar with the differences in the other contracts that also might be presented to you and your client. So for the next few podcasts, what I'm going to do is we're going to play sections of that webinar that discusses the main differences. And of course, these are not the only differences in that contract, but these are typically the most relevant for what you do and what you're going to run across, such as due diligence, repair addendums, and things of that nature. But before we start, I do want to thank you. We have now passed 10,000 downloads of our podcast, Dish and Dirt. This started about 8 months ago, kind of on a whim, didn't know what to really expect, and just been amazed by the support that we're getting from our listeners. So I just really want to thank you guys for helping make this podcast a reality. We are now in our 30th episode. This is episode number 30. And when we started, we were going to do one a month. And because the demand was so high, we decided to do one a week. And we've been doing them one a week now. As I said, this is our 30th episode. So on average, I'm averaging now about 2,000 downloads a month and about 400 or 500 downloads every week. So if you like us and want to see us continue to grow, please don't forget to follow me on Instagram and YouTube, but also don't forget to follow and like and share this podcast. And if you could go up there and click on that little button, particularly on Apple, and give us either a thumbs up or a 4-5-star rating or whatever rating you can give us, that would help my fragile ego. So please do that. I would greatly appreciate it. Now, before I start this section on contract differences, I must reiterate a few things about contracts. Number one, in South Carolina, you are required to present all offers you receive. And this is regardless of which contract or what type of form it is presented to you. It doesn't matter if it's a state contract, the CCRA contract, the Hilton Head contract, or a contract drafted by a member of the South Carolina Bar. You have to present all contracts to your seller, and you must do that within a reasonable time frame. In fact, if somebody submits you a contract offer on a napkin, the old joke is you still have to present that. Do not write in the multiple listing services that you will only accept a contract from a particular service, or you only accept a certain type of contract. I'm seeing this more and more where people will say we're only accepting state contracts. That violates state licensing law and your duty to present any offer. I am not required to present you an offer on any particular type of format. I can present you whatever offer I want, and you must present that offer to your seller. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. You can put in there your client prefers or the seller prefers to receive offers on the state contract or the CCRA contract, but do not put in there that you will only accept certain types of contracts. That is a guaranteed way to get you in trouble with licensing law. Secondly, I would offer that you should be using the contract that's most prevalent in your particular market. Why I say this is because attorneys, lenders, appraisers, inspectors, they're all familiar with the market contract that you have. And so why would we want to go into, say, Greenville which uses the state contract, and present a Central Carolina realtor contract. The other realtor will not understand all those terms unless they spent time looking at them. The lenders aren't going to know them. The closing attorneys up there won't be as familiar with them. The appraisers, the inspectors. Why would you introduce a contract into a market that doesn't use that market? Use that market's contract because that's what the market is familiar with. That's what we're going to know, and that guarantees less problems and less likely that deadlines and things are going to be missed. Conversely, it makes no sense to come in the Central Carolina realtor market and present a state contract because that is not the contract that the agents are using. So I would highly recommend that if you are submitting offers, to submit what is most prevalent in that marketplace. Now, if you get a contract that's not typically used in your market, remember, you do have to present it. You have no options. But what you must do as a real estate agent is to present the differences in that contract to your seller. Your seller may like that offer so much that they do not want to risk a counteroffer and want to go ahead and accept that contract. You must allow your client to do that. And then you better spend some time making sure you truly understand what's in that contract and make sure that you're not going to miss any deadlines or anything of that nature, which makes this podcast very important to you. Also, your client may look at that contract and decide they want to counter. And then you can advise your client as to whether they want to counter on the same format or do they want to counter using your marketplace contract. Now, I've had a lot of agents that say they will get state contracts in the Central Carolina Realtors Association market, and their seller would prefer to counter on the CCRA contract versus the state because they feel more comfortable with CCRA because they've bought a house using that contract before. Maybe they've sold another house using that contract, and they recognize that their agent's probably more familiar with that contract. But remember, the main thing here you have to understand is that it's your client's decision, not yours. The very first legal tip I ever sent out many years ago when I was legal counsel for Russell Jeffcoat is, remember, your client makes a decision, not you. And the more times you try to make decisions for your client is the more often you're going to find yourself facing liability, facing lawsuit, facing grievances, and so forth. You're not your client's mama. You're not your client's daddy. If they make stupid decisions, so be it. Your job is to advise them and advocate and counsel for them, not to make decisions for them. When you make those decisions and those decisions turn out bad, guess what? You're getting sued. You're going to get a grievance filed against you. So now let's move over into the actual webinar. So here's a segment we did on inspections and due diligence. And of course, we're talking about paragraph number 8 under the state contract, as well as paragraph 9 and 10 under CCRA contract. So this is Becky and my discussion along with Byron and Austin.
All right, so let's talk about our inspections and due diligence. Ours is, as y'all know, is quite different. In the state contract, you have the repair procedure, the due diligence, and the as-is. In the CCRA contract, we basically have a due diligence procedure, which allows for requests for repairs, and then we have an as-is procedure. And so I want to start with the as-is. We actually break down in the CCRA contract the as-is into two separate types of as-is. You have 10A and 10B. In 10B, it's as-is with no due diligence. Now, I know the state does allow due diligence, but like our 10B, you cannot get out because of inspection. So in our 10B, if you do a 10B as-is, no due diligence, you're saying, I'm buying this house regardless. I'm not even going to look at it. I just want to buy it. We tell people this is typically when maybe there's a structure like a Lake Murray house that you're planning on tearing down and putting a new structure. Or it could be you're buying a brand new executive construction. The seller is selling an executive construction house they've been in for 3 months. They got relocated. So you don't need or don't worry about doing inspections. You know, it's a new house. It's still under builder warranty. So you're willing to move forward and buy that house with no due diligence. Our second due diligence or second as-is we have is an as-is with a 10-day business day due diligence, just like we have under 9. But the difference here on this one is you can do any inspections you want. You can terminate because you don't like the inspections for any reason whatsoever, basically. But the seller has no obligations to make any repairs. In fact, you're not even to ask for repairs. Either I've done my inspections, I'm going to buy it, or I just don't want to buy it. It's up to you. Now, under our paragraph 9, which is our due diligence in CCRA, you have 10 business days to do due diligence. You can do any type of inspections, tests, assessment you want. It is not limited to termite, heating and air, or any list. It can be anything. You can come into the house, after you have signed the contract and you're ready to buy, and then you can start measuring. And our thought process was, when people buy houses, they don't feel typically don't feel comfortable opening up cabinets, doors, and things of that nature because they don't feel like they have that right yet. But once they're under contract, now they feel a little bit better. They can go in and do more inspections. And so if somebody goes in and finds out, okay, my California king bed actually isn't going to fit in this room, they can get out of the contract. So they can basically do any type of inspections, tests, assessments they want during that 10 business days. And at any time during that 10 business day period, they can terminate for essentially any reason. Our idea was to eliminate buyer remorse as early as possible. And if somebody doesn't want to buy your house, typically they're going to figure out a way to get out of it. We would prefer to have them out in the first 10 business days versus waiting to the very end and trying to come up with some reason to get out at that end that really holds very little water. So the first option is to terminate during that 10 days. If they terminate in the CCRA contract, they are required to provide you copies of any inspection that they did, the full copy, even if that wasn't the reason they terminated. So for instance, if I inspect the house and determine that, okay, my furniture isn't going to fit here, or looking at this house farther, for whatever reason, I don't want to buy it. Even if I have clear termite letter, I still have to provide that clear termite letter to you. Our thought process behind that was, you have a duty to update seller disclosure. And what we did not want to have happen is buyer A backs out of the contract because of a termite issue, doesn't tell you. Buyer B then buys the house, doesn't find the termite issue, and somehow learns about it after closing and decides you didn't update your disclosure. So we try to eliminate that issue right there. Now, the other options that the buyer has is after their inspection period, or excuse me, during their due diligence period, their 10 days, their second option is just accept the property basically as is and move forward. And at that point, all parties are obligated to move forward. The third option is to ask for repairs. As Austin very correctly said, and I have seen this become an issue, is in the state contract, you select either due diligence, repair, or as is. You don't select due diligence and repairs. I've had a client do that in our Greenville office, and it caused a problem. Under your contract, under the state contract, if I recall correctly, gentlemen, is that whichever one selected first, that one rules. I believe there's a statement that says that.
Correct. Yes.
So if you select repair and due diligence, it's going to be repair, correct?
Correct.
Right. All right. Our negotiation period, once you complete you submit the request for repairs and your 10-day period expires, then the seller and buyer have 5 days to negotiate any repairs to any defects that are going to be corrected by seller and sign an addendum. If there's no agreement, they can either extend the negotiation period, or the buyer has 2 days after that period expires to say, okay, I'll still buy it as is. So it gives the buyer the final option so that the seller can't just say, I'm not going to make any repairs, hoping that the buyer will go away and they can take another offer. It still gives that buyer a little bit of control. We didn't want the buyer to be fearful of asking for repairs. You gentlemen, please jump in anytime you want on this. The main differences we're seeing is in the state contract, the buyer and the sellers are selecting the timeframes. There are blanks for them to select timeframes. In the CCRA contract, it is a 10 business day due diligence. With the state, y'all actually allow the seller and the buyer to negotiate what length those periods will be. Secondly, under the repair addendum in the state contract, as Byron said in Austin, is that it is limited to a certain number of items in which they're obligated to fix. There's 6 items, that those are the items we're looking at. And a very important distinction under the repair addendum under the state is that you can't go in and ask for, as Byron said, or maybe as Austin, I want the carpet replaced because I don't like the color of the carpet, or I want the room repainted. I want this done. So, and as Byron did put in the chat,
you can certainly ask for it, but if the seller doesn't do it, you have no recourse to walk away. You can always ask for it. You can always negotiate for it separately, but the expectation needs to be that the seller is not going to do that.
And if the seller says no, they can walk away. They can't. The buyer can't walk away in this.
Not without potentially being sued. Correct.
Right. In the CCRA contract, I can come in and one of my repair addendum requests can be replace the carpet. And if they say no, then the buyer still can walk away. So that's a big difference in the two contracts, is the ability to walk away on those particular items. All right. The other thing is, if seller disagrees to make certain repairs, there's a 2-calendar day chance for the buyer to go forward. Is that correct? Because I remember there's 2 calendar days for the buyer to move forward. If you've asked for certain repairs, because I assume, and you correct me if I'm wrong, If I believe that the heating and air system needs a new condenser and a new compressor, which is one of the six items, but the seller says, no, it doesn't need that. It only needs this. If there's a negotiation breakdown, the buyer has 2 calendar days still to move forward, correct?
Right. So essentially, if the seller agrees to make all those repairs, then that's it. If the seller says, if there's that perfect disagreement of, hey, I don't think your HVAC system's operable, you do. The seller doesn't agree to make that repair by that 6 p.m. deadline here. So now we give 2 calendar days for the parties to either try to work it out, the buyer to say, you know what, I'll buy the house anyway, or to terminate. But if you don't, after those 2 calendar days, if nothing's done, then we have an as-is contract in regards to repairs.
All right. And in the CCRA contract, you have those 2 days for the buyer to decide, well, I'll just buy the house anyway. But the 2 days are business days, where in the state contract, it's calendar days. So you need to understand it. A huge difference in the state contract and the CCRA contract is the use of calendar days versus business days. And so don't get yourself caught in that situation where it's a Saturday, and in the state contract, that would be counted as a calendar day, because a Saturday is a calendar day. But in the CCRA calendar contract, we do not count that as a business day. Under the due diligence provision, again, one of the biggest differences is under the CCRA contract, 10 business days is a set date, where in the state contract, you negotiate the length of that due diligence. And the biggest difference is a termination fee. Under the CCRA contract, there is no termination fee. You can terminate for any reason you want during that 10 business day due diligence period, and you do not have to pay in order to do that. In the state contract, they have the termination fee. And there's arguments, as Byron has said, for it, and there's arguments against it. Both just decided to do different things. This doesn't mean one's right or one's wrong. In the as is, the difference, as I mentioned earlier, was that the buyer may terminate because of inspection results under the 10A provision of as is with due diligence in the CCRA contract. But in the state contract, the buyer cannot terminate solely as a result of the inspections. All right.
I have one question for Austin. The language about the type of the 9 categories, I guess it is, that the buyer can ask in that repair procedure.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed it said that the improvements need to be structurally sound.
Mm-hmm.
Does that encompass then if there are any foundation repairs that are needed?
Yeah, so kind of the thing we give on those is that and environmental concerns are sort of intentionally broad, because we listed out every possible thing that could be. The contract would need it. You need a wheelbarrow to bring it to closing. Mm-hmm. That's foundation issues are kind of the obvious ones, floor joists, things of that sort. We've seen, but we get also ones on the hotline about, hey, there's a cracked tile in the bathroom, there's a cracked fence post. And that's really where parties are going to have to kind of agree. I mean, our recommendation would be, especially when you're doing your initial kind of walkthrough of the house, if there's something big structural that you notice, just do due diligence and don't get in the semantics argument of, hey, is this structurally sound or not? If you walk around, when you're putting an offer in the house and you see, foundation crack, or you see some sort of, big structural issue, just go ahead and do due diligence. That's sort of the recommendation there.
I was thinking of the word improvements as the repairs that they have done need to be structurally sound, but the improvements are the more in the real estate terminology, the improvement on the property, which is the house itself. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, and Brian can certainly add to this here, the intent is that, obviously everything in the house is structurally sound. And then also, what you're doing is you're not, using, chewing gum or duct tape to fix stuff. When you're fixing it, you're actually improving it appropriately.
Okay.
Let me ask you all a question. So basically, if there is a repair that's one of the items, let's say it's a heating and air item, but ultimately there's a dispute as to whether that item needs to be repaired or not, because that's something we have a lot in our industry, is that there'll be competing inspections. Seller's inspection says there's nothing wrong with it. Buyer's inspection says there is. I assume what the court's looking at is twofold. If this falls through with DFTs, ultimately a court's going to look is it one of the required items that a seller would be required to fix, first of all? And secondly, if it is, does that item need to be fixed? And if the court ultimately decides that, yes, this was one of the items of the list, and we believe that the seller should have fixed because it was an item the seller should have fixed, the seller's wrong in their opinion, then the seller could be held at default. Versus if the same analysis goes, but the buyer has asked for something that clearly didn't need to be repaired, the court may decide, while it was an item that needed to be repaired, it fits into the items of the categories, but it wasn't an item, so then buyer could be held at default for not moving forward. Is that essentially what we're looking at in that provision?
Correct. Yeah, that's where I kind of said with repair procedure. Once you sort of cross the easy ones in repair procedure are you go to turn on the AC and nothing comes out.
Okay.
Then that's clearly not operable. Once the air comes out, but it's not your ideal temperature, now we're in sort of a negotiation. So at that point, either the parties come to some mutual agreement of what needs to be fixed, or the seller just says, "Hey, I'm not fixing it." We walk away. And then there may or may not be, litigation. But yeah, as Byron put in the chat, repair procedure is much more, lawyer intensive, I'll say when you're doing repair procedure, your expectation is you get a house that works.
Right.
It doesn't have to be, like I said, you're entitled to a heating system that is operable. You're not entitled to a sauna. You're entitled to a AC system that works. You're not entitled to a blast freezer. Under due diligence, you can be much more specific of, hey, you need to fix this and the AC needs to be blowing out at, whatever.
I think the misconception a lot of CCRA agents may have, because I've had this misconception before I really got into this contract, is that the seller has to fix anything that hits those categories that the buyer says, the inspection report says is wrong. It's no ifs, ands, or buts. So that's really not the case, because if my inspection company is wrong and you have another inspection company that proves they're wrong, I don't get to just say, well, I'm the buyer. Here's my heating and air report. Fix everything on it. And there's no argument about it.
Correct. At that point, so if the buyer's inspector says, hey, this HVAC system is completely kaput, you need to fix it. And the seller inspector says, no, this is perfectly fine. At that point, the party is either, the seller is then going to likely say, hey, I'm not fixing it, which gives us now to that 2 calendar days of the parties either magically come to some agreement, or the buyer just walks away, and then we have a separate earnest money dispute.
Very good. I think today, if nothing else, to me, that clears up that misconception a lot of agents have. And now to our segment, As Gary Sees It.
Waking up in the morning, thinking about so many things.
This week, announcement was made that a titan in our industry is hanging up his hammer and retiring. This gentleman has devoted his entire career to protecting our industry, and we owe him a huge debt of gratitude. I've had the pleasure of working with him for over 8 years when I served on the board of directors. So, of course, I'm talking about Earl McLeod, the executive director of the Building Industry Association of Central Carolina. If many of y'all remember, he was a guest on this show when we discussed the moratorium in Lexington County. Well, Earl has served as the executive director for the Building Industry Association of Central Carolina since 1983. That's right, 38 years. Nobody works anywhere for 38 years. That's a testament to his devotion to his craft and to protecting what we do. Now, Earl was inducted in 2001 into the South Carolina Housing Hall of Fame. He's been the president executive office counsel of the National Association of Home Builders. He served as a vice chairman of the Lexington County Planning Commission. He was a member of the Affordable Housing Task Force for the City of Columbia, the Board of Trustees for the Home Builder Industry in Washington, D.C. He has seen this association through both fat and lean times, including saving, in my opinion, the association's very existence in the Midlands during the Great Recession. Whether you're in the Midlands, the Low Country, or the Upstate, it doesn't matter. Earl was always fighting for the industry as a whole throughout the state. What I always admired most about Earl is his willingness to listen to others, accept ideas and plans that might not have been his, or he may not even agree with, and he would make those ideas work. He would mold these ideas and always make them into workable plans. He was always most interested in what was best for the industry and how to make sure that the builders were protected, which thus protected the real estate agents. So without a doubt, our industry is losing a giant, but we absolutely wish Earl and his beautiful wife, Judy, our absolute best, and hope they enjoy retirement and enjoy those grandkids. And now on to Gary's good news only. We're going to talk about coronavirus.
Coronavirus! Coronavirus!
Now, this is from a wonderful website called Rational Ground. And this is an article that talks about whether COVID is more like the flu or not. Now, Rational Ground is not some crazy nut job conspiracy theory website. This is a website that was formed by doctors from around the country that wanted to provide clear evidence of what was going on with COVID. They want to provide good news and make people truly understand COVID. So if you would go in there and read some of these articles, you'll see these people really know what they're talking about. So in this article here, they said, to be clear, COVID-19 is not a hoax at all. It's real. It causes real-world damage, real-world heartbreak,
but it is not the killer that's been made out to be. The first thing they make, a point they make in this article, which I think is great, and I'll just read this part, is conversely, the public health response to COVID-19 has been an abysmal failure. At every turn, the effects and danger of COVID-19 have been exaggerated, and the collateral damage of government mandates and government and media-induced panic have been swept under the rug. Official after official has turned a blind eye to once accepted science standards, only to follow the virtue signaling, having to do something crowd. The worst example of this tendency was the last summer when public health officials condoned mass protests as public health events. So how do we do it? How do we turn a disease that is equivalent to a bad flu into a world disaster? We overact. We change the way we detect viruses. We change the way we record deaths. We try to control the uncontrollable. We use COVID-19 as a political tool. We destroyed literally and metaphorically tens of thousands of lives in panic, lockdowns, and restrictions, and we set in motion events that ensured the devastation will continue for years. These are bold statements flying against the prevailing narrative, she says. In perhaps the most significant panic-fueled move, the CDC changed how mortality statistics are gathered, and COVID-19 labeled deaths became ubiquitous. Previous to the change, COVID-19 needed to be an underlying condition in a chain of events that led directly to the immediate cause of death for the death to be considered a COVID-19 death. But under the new guidelines, instead of having to be an underlying cause of death, if COVID-19 was merely a contributing factor, the death would be labeled a COVID-19 death. Thus, an Alzheimer's patient on death's door who was pushed that last step through the door of COVID-19 was now a full-blown COVID-19 labeled death. Never mind that the flu was never treated this way, and such a change made COVID-19 labeled deaths incomparable to any other mode of death. These deaths are now COVID-19 deaths. This change in record keeping became a fuel to power long-term panic, and was as we became more efficient in finding COVID-19, we also became more willing to put COVID-19 on a death certificate regardless of its level of contribution to the death. I have been preaching that for 9 months, that these death numbers are completely inflated and in a lot of ways are just complete BS. This is more evidence. Read this article. It basically spells it out in scientific and mathematical terms exactly what we're looking at. Now, NPR has even gotten into this game now, and the COVID versus the flu, this is the kids' version. Hospitalizations numbers look worse for COVID-19, but those numbers are inflated as a result of the CDC's reporting rules. The CDC requires every child admitted to a hospital to be tested for coronavirus. Dr. Roshini Mathew, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Stanford University, you know, your typical little neighborhood school, Stanford University School of Medicine, says experience at her hospital found that 45% of the time, a child who tested positive for the coronavirus was not actually sick with Corona 19. The findings have been published online in the journal Hospital Pediatrics. In those cases, hospitalization was due to a completely unrelated diagnosis like appendicitis, femur fracture, or something else. For children in particular, the risk of serious consequences for COVID-19 is the same magnitude as the risk they face from the flu. So even NPR is finally recognizing this complete panic porn. So the third piece of good news I saw was antibodies. Months after recovering from mild cases of COVID-19, people are still having immune cells in their body pumping out antibodies against the virus that causes COVID-19. According to the study from the researchers at Washington State University School of Medicine in St. Louis, which is also another great university, such cells could persist for a lifetime, churning out antibodies all the while. So basically, if you've had COVID, you could be immune forever. But according to an article on EurekaAlert.org, this is what they said. Last fall, these reports of antibodies waning quickly after infection with the virus that caused COVID-19. And of course, the mainstream media interpreted that to mean that the immunity was not long-lived, said senior author Ali Alabadi, a PhD and associate professor of pathology and immunology of medicine and molecular microbiology. It's so difficult I can't even pronounce it. But that's a misinterpretation of the data. It is normal for antibody levels to go down after acute infection, but they don't go down to zero. They plateau. Here we found antibody-producing cells in people 11 months after the first symptoms. These cells will live and produce antibodies for the rest of the people's life. That's strong evidence of long-lasting immunity. Again, panic porn media did not want you to know that. Our 7-day tracker, the current 7-day moving average of daily cases, down 19.5%. Over the highest peak is down 90%. It's gone, guys. It's done. 7-day average for hospitalizations down 15.1%. And the current deaths, new deaths, decreased 10.5% from the previous 7-day. So there you have it. Gary's good news only. And that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed learning the differences in the contracts. We will continue to do this for the next couple of weeks until we finish this entire topic. I hope everybody likes it. If you will, please like us, share us, and subscribe to us. We would greatly appreciate it. I hope everyone has a wonderful weekend.